Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Midlife Wellness MP podcast. My name is Kim Hefner. I'm a board certified family nurse practitioner, menopause specialist, and host of the podcast. Today, I welcome Dr. Angela Mazza. She is a DO. She is triple board certified in endocrinology, anti-aging and regenerative medicine, and internal medicine. She is also the medical director for the Metabolic Center of Wellness and the author of the new book, Thyroid Talk. Today, we're going to jump into the impact of perimenopause and menopause on thyroid function, Hashimoto's, and a lot more. So stick around for a great conversation and welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, yeah. I think we're going to have a great conversation. I think it's going to add a lot of value to women in perimenopause and menopause and really at all ages. So super excited to have this conversation. Tell us a little bit more about yourself. I know I gave a little intro before I got on with you, but okay. Just talk about yourself a little bit, your background, where you're from, what your practice is all about.
Sure. Well, I'm an integrative endocrinologist. So if anybody is not familiar with integrative medicine, it's really a combination of functional medicine and traditional medicine. So the, you know, functional medicine is great. It's really like holistic medicine, getting to the root cause, which is good. It's very patient driven. It sometimes can take a long period of time. It doesn't always resolve everything. Whereas traditional medicine doesn't really get to the root cause. So it kind of puts a band-aid on things. It's like treating diabetes without addressing diet and exercise. But integrative medicine actually combines both functional and traditional. So, and I find that works best, especially for thyroid issues. So, as an integrative endocrinologist, I care for people with all hormone issues. But I didn't start out as an integrative endocrinologist. I really had traditional osteopathic training. I went in the osteopathic route because I've always been interested in whole body wellness. I did a traditional internal medicine and endocrinology fellowship. We were talking about in St. Louis University. I'm originally from outside of Philly though. But then came down to Florida where I started my career as an endocrinologist. And it wasn't shortly after I started working in a hospital-based system that I found that I wasn't always helping my patients. I was finding a lot of patients with thyroid issues because I was the only one in the practice that did thyroid nodule biopsy. So I was getting a lot of the thyroid patients and I found that we weren't adequately treating thyroid patients. We were missing a lot of persons with thyroid disease. I felt like my patients weren't living up to their quality of life that they deserve. And I was getting frustrated too, because I felt like I wasn't really helping anyone. So luck has it, I came into integrative medicine and did training in that. And then I opened my own practice called Metabolic Center for Wellness right outside of Orlando, where on a daily basis, I care for persons with hormone issues. So that's just like yourself, women with hormone issues and men with hormone issues. My main focus is on overall wellness and thyroid issues. So all types of thyroid issues. So underactive or overactive. So hypothyroidism, hyperthyroidism, autoimmune thyroid disease, thyroid nodules, thyroid cancer. We are the only center in Central Florida that offers the non-surgical treatment for thyroid nodules, which is called radiofrequency ablation. So the benefit of that is we're saving thyroids on a regular basis, saving people from going through thyroid surgery and ending up without a thyroid. So it's really rewarding. We're having great feedback. So that's kind of my background.
That's awesome. I mean, that's a great background. That's awesome. Was there something that drove you into this field to begin with? Was there anything, were you experiencing issues or just how did you end up there?
Well, I went into the field of endocrinology because diabetes runs in my family. So I really found that that was kind of like the main reason I went into endocrinology. And I just really loved, like, hormones are so esoteric. I mean, they affect everything. They're like the little chemical messengers that deliver signals all over body. And I just really, that was always been an interest of mine.
Okay. Yeah. Hormones are huge. I mean, they really do influence everything. It's crazy. Well, let's talk about your book a little bit. You've got a recent book out, Thyroid Talk, right? Yeah. Why did you write it? What can readers expect to get out of it? And then talk a little bit about your podcast and the course, the course that goes along as a follow-up to your book. Share about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, I had always wanted to write a book, but I never really had the time. Then COVID came along and I had a little bit more time. And I started thinking, how can I spread more information that's research-driven, fact in regards to thyroid? Because we got to a point with our practice, and we were blessed to have this point where we couldn't really take in or take on any new patients. So basically, right now, we're only taking on patients for thyroid nodule biopsies and nodule ablations, like the procedure I was telling you about. But on a regular basis, we have people calling, and they're looking for help. They need help. I wanted to find a way, some sort of avenue to help people who are looking for thyroid help, and to help physicians and medical care, healthcare providers learn more about thyroid. Because I feel like as healthcare professionals, we're missing a lot of thyroid disease and patients aren't getting the care that they need, and people are not living up to their life's potential due to maybe their thyroid's not optimal. Mm-hmm. So I started writing the book. And it came along at around the same time as the podcast. So podcast is Thyroid Talk with Dr. Angela Mazza, where we discuss thyroid topics on a regular basis. We try and make it fun. My co-host Dawn Sheffield and I, she kind of represents the patient perspective. And we try and make interesting conversation out of sometimes not so interesting topics. So we make it fun. And we talk about, labs, we talk about different types of thyroid issues. We have guests on, we talk about menopause. That was one of our most recent episodes with Dr. Felice Gersh.
She's great.
She's awesome.
Was that great? I'll have to go back and listen to that. I'm excited.
Oh, yeah.
She's great. I really like her. Yeah. I want to get her on. Yeah. I need
she's
to
awesome.
Talk to her.
Yeah. But the book and the podcast kind of organically came along together. And then I finished the book. The book was, chapter by chapter, what are questions that people have? What are questions that I get on a regular basis and that are out there? And sometimes my patients come in and they inspire me, like, oh, I heard about this. Is that right? Or is that wrong? So, and things aren't always right that are out there. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to get, like I mentioned, research-driven fact information when it comes to your health. So that's how the book came into fruition. And then I finished the book and we were like thinking, what if someone reads the book and the book doesn't do it? I mean, you can read the book and it's a lot of information, but maybe they need a little bit more guidance. So that's why we started the, it's called Thrive Through Thyroid. You can get more information at thrivethyroid.com, but it's a masterclass where we kind of module through module go through, is your thyroid in crisis? How are thyroid issues diagnosed? What are the lab values that you need to look at your thyroid? What are the micronutrients you need? How do you determine gut health and how do you take care of it? So we kind of go through all of that. And what the cool thing is, we have the modules, but then we have a once a month live coaching session where it's me, our members can sign on, ask me any question that you want, and then we try and kind of field the questions as they come along. So that the goal is just to help out in the overall spreading of important thyroid knowledge.
Wow, that's a lot. That's great. That sounds like an awesome resource. That's awesome. Let me ask you this. When it comes to conventional medicine and integrative medicine or functional medicine, when you're evaluating a patient, how do you bring those both approaches in, and what kind of lab panels are you looking at? Maybe outside of just thyroid function, what do you need to get a good look at overall thyroid function?
Great question, because I feel like practitioners, we fall short. We just look at labs and we don't look at the labs that are telling the whole story. But it's so important. I also encourage my patients, we need to know how you're feeling. So there is not one system in our body that is not affected by thyroid. You're hard pressed to find one. So it's how you're feeling. I always discuss signs versus symptoms. So signs are what a patient feels. So I want my patient to tell me, are you feeling tired? Are you sleeping? Any changes in skin or hair, constipation, going through the whole kind of list of how they're feeling system by system. What I see in return are symptoms. So I log symptoms. And it's important to do at every single visit because as things change, you kind of have to know what's changing. Because what I've also found as things get better, people forget about, oh yeah, my hair's not falling anymore. Or so that's kind of the signs and symptoms are important to follow during progression. But the labs are key too. So the labs and how a person's feeling, just the signs and the symptoms I see go hand in hand. One does not go without the other. We kind of over time have gone through back in the beginning of thyroid hormone replacement, we only relied on signs and symptoms. And that kind of led to people being overdosed on medicines. It was kind of not the most scientific thing. But then the advent of our fancy TSH levels led patients to only be judged by TSH. So the key thing is now we're kind of the pendulum is swinging back where we need to look at both. Now to get back to your question, what are the labs that we need? So TSH is not the be all end all. So thyroid stimulating hormone is an indirect measure of thyroid function, because it comes from the pituitary gland. So the pituitary, in essence, if ideal situations, if the pituitary is sensing we're not making enough thyroid hormone or not taking in enough thyroid hormone or making too much thyroid hormone, it's in reflection of that. So yes, the thyroid stimulating hormone is important. It is the gold standard of screening. So it is important. But we also need to know what exactly the thyroid is doing. So that's T4 and T3. So the thyroid mainly makes T4. T4, it makes a little bit of T3, but when it's released into our circulation, most of the T3, which is active thyroid hormone, is converted from T4 to T3. So most of that happens in our system. So if we don't have those levels in relation to also the TSH, that's key. And we need free levels because things like estrogen are going to make more binding protein, and that's going to affect how much actual thyroid hormone is available for use. Because we can't use hormones that's bound by protein. We need to know the free values. I also always check for most patients' thyroid antibodies. So thyroid antibodies are a reflection of anything autoimmune going on. So most of the patients I see already have some sort of known thyroid issue. So I do follow them on a regular basis because it gives me an idea of what's going on with the immune system. If someone doesn't have a thyroid issue or any sort of thyroid abnormality, maybe it's not worth checking every single time. So, I mean, if you're just a routine kind of follow-up visit, and someone doesn't have a thyroid issue, probably you don't need the antibodies. I do always check reverse T3. So reverse T3, so T4 is converted to either T3, which is active thyroid hormone, or reverse T3. So reverse T3 is inactive thyroid hormone. The tough thing about reverse T3 is since it's so close in structure as free T3, reverse T3 can also bind or block the same receptors that we need active T3 to get to. So that means if active T3 can't get to the cell and do what it needs to do, we start having the symptoms of metabolic problems. So the metabolism is going to be affected. That's when our patients start feeling fatigued, cold, constipated, sleeping issues. So the reverse T3 is key. Plus, it can also tell us if something else is going on, underlying illness or too much T4 can actually cause reverse T3 to be high. You don't want a high reverse T3. And then finally, I always screen for micronutrients. Micronutrients are key to how thyroid works. So I do screen for iodine levels. So iodine is key in our own thyroid hormones production. So we need iodine to make thyroid hormone. But if we're making too much or taking in too much or not enough, it is going to impact thyroid function. So Long answer to your
question. No, it's great. A couple things. You know, a lot of practitioners or clinicians don't use reverse T3 very often. They don't find it clinically useful. But I agree with you. I think it is useful. You mentioned a couple things, but reverse T3 can also, what are some other reasons why that would be high? And then what strategies are you using to get that lower?
So that's a great question. So there's so many things that are associated with reverse T3. So I mentioned too much T4. So that's a fixable thing. I mean, you adjust if someone's on something that has T4 in it. So thyroid hormone replacement, like levothyroxine or even a desiccated thyroid hormone does have T4 in it. So that's a fixable thing. But so many chronic conditions are associated with reverse T3. So type 2 diabetes, chronic fatigue, depression, malnutrition, dieting, even overexercise, dementia. So there's like so many things that are associated with reverse T3. And the importance of reverse T3 is that it reflects mitochondrial function.
That's huge.
Mitochondria are the powerhouses of our cells. So if we don't have functioning mitochondria, we can't make energy. So if you think about it, you can have the most perfect thyroid replacement in the world, but if you don't have the mitochondria to listen to the signal that the thyroid's sending, you're just not getting anywhere because you can't make energy. So reverse T3? Well,
you're like, okay, so we got reverse T3. You need to make sure mitochondria are functioning. So then how do we boost mitochondrial function? Because that isn't just related to thyroid. It's everything.
It's key. Yes. So the first thing to do, yes, you want to look at it. Are there reversible things that we can fix? If someone is malnourished, you know, it doesn't always look obvious to you if someone's malnourished. You can actually be normal looking and be malnourished. But beside the fact, if you can reverse the underlying condition, that's good. But what I always start with is you just start feeding the mitochondria. So mitochondria need CoQ10. So CoQ10 essentially feeds the mitochondria. So CoQ10 or ubiquinol. So ubiquinol is the reduced form. It's kind of a pure form of CoQ10. That's a good place to start.
Is there one form better than the other?
I like the ubiquinol just because I feel like it's a little purer.
Okay. And I read that if you're going to take that, should you take, I think it was 100 to 300 milligrams and then take it in divided doses with food. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I would just start with 100. And then when you recheck levels, see where you're at with the reverse T3.
Okay. And then when you mentioned doing a nutrient panel, is this just through Quest or is this a specialty lab or how do we go about doing a nutrient panel?
Great question. So there are, I have patients that have insurance and don't have insurance and some are okay with paying for advanced functional testing, but I try and use insurance as much as I can. So micronutrients, you can check individual micronutrients with Quest or LabCorp or any hospital. So like a urinary iodine, insurance will cover. Iron is a key micronutrient for thyroid function because the enzyme in the thyroid that makes thyroid hormone called thyroperoxidase is a heme protein. So it needs iron. And I found, and I think that you probably screen a lot of women too, we are iron deficient.
Yeah.
If you don't have iron, your thyroid can't work right. You can't make thyroid hormone.
Thanks for explaining that because that's really important.
It's huge. It's huge. Yeah. I mean, and once I started screening for that, there's a lot of women who had slightly abnormal thyroid function where I'm like, I don't want to put this person on thyroid hormone replacement. I want to see if doesn't just scream out to me, this person needs thyroid hormone replacement. And if you check micronutrients and iron's low, you get that ferritin level up. The thyroid has what it needs to work better. So lots of times we ignore micronutrients. And if we give our patients the right micronutrients, their thyroid's going to work better.
Okay. I have a question. You may or may not know if seen this. What about if the ferritin is low, but then their serum iron is high?
Yeah.
That's tricky. What do you like? Because
it's tricky.
I feel like serum iron can be from supplementation or intake, but then their ferritin storage is low. So how do you navigate that?
Well, that's where I kind of defer to the ferritin, because the ferritin is really going to be the key thing. If you have a percent saturation or an iron binding capacity, chances are the iron binding capacity is going to be high and the percent saturation is going to be low. So you're going to be okay with giving some iron replacement.
Okay. Yeah. That was the thing. Cause it's like, they still need to build
they
it up because their stores are low, and it can take what, about 3 months or so to build the stores back up.
And then guess what? If you have a woman who's still having a period, then she has her period again, and then she loses iron all over again.
Right. Right. So okay. Okay. That makes sense, because sometimes I find that I have patients with high iron, and that can be dangerous, but then their ferritin is like so low, and I'm like, you can't feel good, So it's just the things that show up are crazy.
And it's so hard sometimes, because the symptoms of iron deficiency and hypothyroidism can be very similar.
Right.
So, I mean, fatigue, cold intolerance, hair loss, I mean, that could be either.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And thanks for clarifying the urinary iodine, because that was one of my questions as well. Some people don't feel like you need to check it, but if you do, what's the gold standard? And you said urinary iodine. Does it matter what time of the day?
No, I mean, and I always will do the gold standard would be if you do a 24-hour urine collection, but nobody wants to do that. So I usually do like a random urine with a random urine for creatinine as well. So you can kind of extrapolate out a 24-hour urine collection, and you want it to be at least between 100 and 250 micrograms per liter.
Okay.
What I've been finding is, again, I have a lot of patients with thyroid issues. People take thyroid hormone supplements or thyroid supplements.
Right.
So every single thyroid hormone supplement out there right now has iodine in it.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of iodine.
Right. And I read with Hashimoto's, you can have iodine, right? But you don't want a certain amount. Is that right? Or how do you feel about that?
Too much. Yes. Yes. Okay. It's a narrow window, because we just want between 100 and 250 micrograms per day.
Okay.
So what can happen if not enough iodine isn't good, because then the thyroid can't make thyroid hormone, but too much can either shut the thyroid down, especially in the setting of autoimmune thyroid issues, or it can put it into overdrive.
Okay. So without checking iodine, how would one even know that iodine is deficient?
Yeah.
Would they be experiencing like fatigue, similar symptoms then, just symptoms of,
Well, it can actually just mess up their thyroid function in general. That can be the sole reason.
Okay.
Yeah.
There was some new research out while we're on nutrients about selenium and the ability to reverse antibodies, correct?
Yeah.
That's good research and the positive use of selenium. Do you recommend supplementation with selenium, or some people just eat Brazil nuts. I mean, what is your thoughts on that?
Well, selenium is one that I don't check unless I'm getting a full micronutrient. So to answer the rest of the other question, I do full micronutrient, more functional testing. So that checks all the micronutrients.
Okay.
Now, as far as selenium, yes, there's a ton of really good research on selenium, because selenium is a key part of glutathione. So glutathione, especially glutathione peroxidase, helps protect the thyroid. So if we think about thyroid hormone production, so making thyroid hormone within the thyroid gland itself is actually an oxidative process. So poor thyroid, so sensitive to start with, and it's doing its job, but it has the potential to damage itself. So the glutathione peroxidase helps with that. And selenium is a key part of that. Plus, it's also a part in the enzymes that make thyroid hormone too. So selenium has a twofold, more than twofold benefits. But we have studies that show that selenium can decrease thyroid antibodies in persons with Hashimoto thyroiditis, which is the most common cause of autoimmune thyroid disease in the U.S. And by adding in selenium, that can help save the remainder of the thyroid. And by the reverse, selenium deficiency has been linked to the emergence of autoimmune thyroid issues.
Mm. Okay. Is there a certain dose that we should take? Is it dangerous to take too much?
It's really tough to overdose on selenium. So I usually recommend 200 micrograms a day.
Is there certain forms?
The selenomethionine is the best form because it's most readily absorbed. Selenomethionine. But, you know, if you have that patient that doesn't want to take extra supplements, that's where the two Brazil nuts comes in.
Okay.
So taking two Brazil nuts a day essentially is 200 micrograms.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So that's good too.
Okay. All right. Cool. Glad we clarified that.
Those are big nuts to eat though. I mean,
they are. How do you feel about those thyroid mix supplements, by the way?
The thyroid supplements?
The combination. Is there anyone that you like?
If someone is iodine deficient, pure encapsulations has a good thyroid hormone support. Douglas Labs used to have a thyroid support that didn't have iodine in it. So I use that a lot, but pure encapsulation, but again, it has iodine in it. So, just be careful and monitor.
Okay. What are some thyroid misconceptions or myths? What do we get wrong when it comes to the thyroid?
I think there's a lot we get wrong when it comes to the thyroid. I think the key thing from a healthcare standpoint is if your labs are within the normal range, then it's not the thyroid causing your symptoms. So if someone's coming in with fatigue, difficulty losing weight, and their levels, even if it's TSH, T4, and T3, if they're all within the range, you should be okay. It's not the thyroid. But we found that those ranges are based off of really all comers and huge population studies. So all ages, both sexes, all races. So when we look closer, there's more optimal ranges for most people that are much smaller than those large ranges.
Mm.
I think another one that is a common misconception is kind of what we alluded to already about not everybody needs to be on thyroid hormone replacement. Sometimes just giving the thyroid what it needs, it works really well. I think another misconception is when it comes to thyroid antibodies. So if you know someone has thyroid antibodies or someone's checked it, but the thyroid levels are technically within normal range, there's nothing to do. But that's not true because That's the best situation because you have the chance to intervene and prevent the autoimmune disease from progressing. You have the opposite of that autoimmune assault. So that's where kind of really digging into gut health is important. Really working on stress management is important, like those types of things, because that's the key. We want to keep the thyroid levels good and prevent progression.
Let me ask you this. Am I going a little bit? Sorry. Let me ask you this. Patients come in and they have a positive ANA or they just have mildly elevated antibodies to thyroid. What is that indicating? Say they've got a positive ANA, but they don't have a lot of other symptoms, or if any symptoms, or they just have these antibodies that are mildly elevated. Does that indicate that they have Hashimoto's, or does it need to reach a certain level before they're diagnosed with Hashimoto's?
Great question, because there's debate that if you have any antibodies, are they okay? Because if you think about antibodies are a reflection of the immune system. So the immune system is reacting. And those antibodies take a while to start developing. And I always refer to, if you've ever heard of like the autoimmune triangle. So the autoimmune triangle, for your listeners, is genetics. So one tip of the triangle is genetics, and we don't have a lot of control over that. One tip of the triangle is things we're exposed to over time. So like environmental triggers where, you know, as we've grown up, you know, viruses we've had or stressors we've had or medicines we've been given, things we've been exposed to in the environment or thyroid disruptors. So that's one, again, that we don't have much control over that. But that's where those antibodies start brewing. And then the third part is the gut. So if you don't do anything, if you don't do anything to prevent the progression, it's just going to keep going. I mean, you need, when it comes to Hashimoto thyroiditis, you need a significant amount of destruction of the thyroid gland to start affecting thyroid function. Mm-hmm. So, and yes, I see antibodies are very, very high. I see antibodies that are low. What's interesting, and I wish, you know, I could show you actual visualization, but I do a lot of ultrasounds. So I do thyroid ultrasounds on a regular basis. So I look at nodules, but I also can see changes on the ultrasound. So when we look at someone who just has early on maybe antibodies, that thyroid tissue looks nice and normal. But if you see thyroid gland over time with someone with Hashimoto thyroiditis, it starts getting punched out. It looks like Swiss cheese. It starts becoming fibrotic. And you can actually see where there's not much thyroid tissue left. And that's because nothing, that person didn't know. I mean, they were just kind of going along. It didn't have any problems until they started having symptoms. And then once someone has signs and symptoms, it's still possible to reverse it, but it's more challenging. That autoimmune assault is continuing. Because you can't put back thyroid tissue. We can stop the salt, but so yeah. Sounds so the antibodies are there. They're not just floating around because that's normal.
Right. So what is your first steps when you have somebody like that? I'm sure it's individual, case by case, but overall, when you have somebody that comes in and you notice that these antibodies are positive or they have a positive ANA, what steps, what's the process look like?
Well, if their thyroid levels are still within a good range, we don't just all of a sudden jump to thyroid hormone replacement. Okay. But again, it's an individual basis. And this is in the setting of Hashimoto thyroiditis. I will do micronutrient testing, and that person's going to be on selenium.
Okay.
We do a lot of gut health. So I do treat for leaky gut or intestinal permeability. There's some debate about whether you should test for it or not. I kind of like to test for it as well as food sensitivities, because one, it gives a patient idea of what's going on in their gut. Plus the food sensitivity testing will tell you exactly what's causing inflammation at the level of the gut. Because the gut's that part of the triangle that we can make a difference. We can't go back in time and change environmental factors, and we can't change genes, but we can change gut. Because the gut is really that semi-permeable barrier that protects us from what we take from the external environment to our internal environment. And if that gets damaged, what happens is we're taking in things like undigested food and bacteria and toxins into our internal environment. And that's what's triggering the immune system to get confused. So Hashimoto thyroiditis just happens to be one of the most common ones, but there's local immune issues that can happen. Celiac issues, ulcerative colitis, other things like rheumatoid arthritis, anything in the ANA that you're alluding to is linked to the gut. So we really work a lot on gut health. Everybody should be on a probiotic if they're not on a probiotic.
Which probiotic? Like there's
a million and one out there, right?
Spore based, there's regular strains? I mean, I get this question all the time. I have a few that I really like.
Yeah.
Does it matter if they're spore based or like for Hashimoto's, is one better than the other?
I don't think so. I think as long as you got one on board, it's got lactobacillus in it, and it's got at least 15 billion cultures, you're in good shape.
Okay.
The key thing with probiotics is you don't want to stick with the same one all the time.
Okay.
You want to change them. You can go back to one you really like, you know, later on. But what you want to do is increase the diversity of the gut microbiome, because that strengthens its usefulness as an immune, because that's really what it is. It's immunity.
Do you use Espilardi a lot or no?
Sometimes. It all kind of.
I kind of read that was good for immune function and Hashimoto's. But when we talk about gut health, I have people that will say they'll have positive antibodies or positive ANA, but they say, I'm pooping every day. I don't think I have a gut issue. I don't want to do testing or treatment. I'm like, well, these other symptoms are, but they don't understand that. Can you explain that a little bit? Say they are pooping every single day. They're not having bloating and other things, but then they have positive antibodies or, you know, autoimmune response. What do you say to that?
Well, there's symptoms other than GI that a lot of people experience that are related to gut health and that go along with an ANA. So if patients who have brain fog, who are fatigued, who have inflammatory complaints on a regular basis, joint pain, that's in relation to gut health too. So making changes in taking out inflammatory foods and working on gut health. I usually tell people, okay, if you at least cut out gluten and pasteurized dairy and take your probiotic for 2 weeks, you tell me if you don't feel better in general.
Okay.
And most of the time people are like, you know what? I did feel like I had, and I say, you got to keep a log too on a day-to-day basis. Most people feel better.
So cut out gluten. Gluten's a given.
Gluten's inflammatory to everyone.
Okay.
No matter what, we have studies that show that even if you don't have any autoimmune issue, we see transient zonulin. So zonulin's really the gatekeeper in the intestinal lining. We see transient elevations. It's just a matter of how quickly you can recover. And I tell people, I'm not saying you got to be gluten-free. You're not, if you don't have celiac disease, you don't have to be gluten-free, but just limited, you know.
And what did you say about dairy?
Pasteurized dairy tends to be inflammatory to most people too.
Okay. So don't get the pasteurized eggs.
Eggs are kind of a different story. Pasteurized eggs. I'm talking like milk, processed cheeses.
I like cheese. Okay.
Hard cheeses are fine. Fermented cheeses are okay.
Okay.
But I'm just trying to limit them, because the more we decrease inflammation at the level of the gut, that's just better for decreasing those autoimmune titers.
Are you using things like glutamine for the gut? Is that typically the standard? Glutamine is kind of what I've used, a combination of things.
Glutamine's great. We have so many things in our gut toolbox now. So, I mean, glutamine's good. I use a lot of aloe vera. Aloe vera's good. There's just so many things that are available now for the gut. Colostrum's good. So, and it's just,
how do you know their gut's healed?
Well, you know that's saying? Great. If you recheck, then you know. I mean, if you see,
everybody says to heal your gut, but then when do we know it's healed? If, you know, they never knew they had a problem. You know?
Exactly. That's the benefit of testing. Whereas I know we can assume everyone may have a leaky gut, but again, you want some sort of gauge of what's getting better, because my patients want to know, is what I'm doing working? So yes, signs and symptoms, if you're feeling better, that's a good sign. If your thyroid antibodies are going down, that's a good sign.
Okay.
Recheck, then you know. But
are you rechecking just like you standardly would every 4 to 6 weeks after?
Oh, for gut, I'll maybe do it a year later.
Yearly, okay.
Just because it can be expensive.
It is expensive and it's not very fun. It's not a fun test.
Vibrant Wellness has a really good one for gut testing that is just a finger stick.
Oh, really? For the gut?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it tests for zonulin, LPS or lipopolysaccharide, and what was it? Actin.
Okay. I didn't know that. I've used their stool test. I really like their stool test. But now that's great to know. Awesome. Do you use them for the micronutrients and food sensitivities as well?
I do too, because the micronutrients is a blood draw, but the food sensitivity, again, is a finger stick. So like 96 different foods.
That's really
good. They have a second panel too. That's, I want to say it's like 94, but.
Okay. I think the food sensitivity is a great idea. Not everybody wants to do it. But I will tell you, when I was going through all my digestive stuff, I was a nightmare, joint pain so bad, I would wake up. I was having a sensitivity to chicken, of all things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, once you start having sensitivities, the sensitivities keep happening.
I mean, like chicken. I was thinking I was being healthy. I'm throwing it on salad. I'm like, right. I feel terrible. And so just learning that made a huge difference for me. So I'm a fan. Let's talk a little bit about perimenopause and menopause and the impact on thyroid function.
Okay.
So yeah, what changes, you know, we're going through these hormonal fluctuations of estrogen up and down during perimenopause, and progesterone, I heard, has a lot to do with thyroid function. Can you just talk about the impact of those hormone fluctuations and what the impact on thyroid is?
Oh yeah. And it's kind of like multifaceted. So it's not even just a straight black and white thing. But yeah, perimenopause and menopause, we start seeing declines in estrogen, and estrogen itself has immune modulatory effects. So when we're dealing with anything with immune function, that has the potential to correlate with the thyroid. So one of the big times, so menopause, perimenopause, early 40s, some women are having it earlier than that, through menopause. That also tends to be the time where we see a lot of emergence of thyroid issues, especially autoimmune, and it's a couple of things. So I think it's the changes in our immune system that happen during that time of our lives. But I also feel like it's the stress on the body during that time too, because for a lot of women, they can be very symptomatic, start having sleep issues that can cause stress and fatigue, and like they kind of beget themselves. So that's where we tend to see thyroid issues. But there's also the other end of the spectrum too, because estrogen increases thyroid binding globulin. So I mentioned earlier about TBG. So what we can also see if a woman's already on thyroid hormone replacement, their requirements may change a little bit, because they don't have as much bound circulating thyroid hormone. So there's going to be more free available. So say someone's on levothyroxine or whatever form of thyroid hormone replacement, they don't have that estrogen circulating or not as much. They're going to have more free available. So they may become more, their requirements may go down. Now, there was an interesting study just as far as estrogen deficiency. I don't know if you saw it. It was really, really recent in rats that were essentially made menopausal, and they replaced them with estrogen. It actually increased T3 production.
Okay.
Which is kind of, so it's like we don't know 100%. And to make it worse, the symptoms of perimenopause and menopause overlap with thyroid so much. Now, progesterone increases T4 to T3 conversion. And I just think progesterone is like one of the best things in the world, because it stimulates our GABA receptors. It's calming. It balances out estrogen, and especially estrogen dominance. And with estrogen being in that condition, very inflammatory. So anything inflammation isn't good for our thyroid. But to answer your question, there's a lot of different changes. And as women, we're so complicated. And it, you know, you put stress on top of it.
Right. So if perimenopause, if they're having estrogen dominant symptoms, then you would expect them to have more bound.
Yes. Well,
so then they would be experiencing low thyroid symptoms.
Exactly. Right?
Okay. What if you give people, okay, so I know oral estrogen, if people take oral estrogen, that changes things, right? So that would mean their thyroid levels would be need to be increased.
Yeah.
Dose would be increased because more would be bound.
Exactly.
Okay.
So you got it.
To clarify that, they would have less circulating thyroid hormone to exert its effect. So
exactly.
Okay. You're trying to clarify that. People are probably like, who cares? What about the binding? What does that mean?
It's important.
It's important. So when you have more hormone that is bound to these proteins like SHBG and thyroid binding globulin, then you have less hormone active for your body to use.
Exactly. It's there, but it's not available for use.
Right.
Right.
Yes. So that's important because you see
that's where total levels of things, even testosterone, if you check total levels, it's there, but it's not available for use. It's only the free levels that are available.
Right. And there's changes over time as we age with those binding globulins. So it's definitely important to check that. What do you see particularly with women in thyroid? What challenges do they face during this transition time? And how can they differentiate? Because those hypoactive thyroid symptoms are similar to the menopausal symptoms. Even myself, I'm like, okay, my hair is dry. Is it my low estrogen? Is it my low thyroid? What do I need here?
It's tough. That's where, again, logging your symptoms is important. Okay. And I'll even have patients that I'll say, it doesn't feel like thyroid. It feels like it. That's where knowing your body helps out. And again, that's where accurate labs, optimal labs help out too. So it's kind of like an objective, okay, are my thyroid levels within the optimal range? Are they not in the optimal range? So that's where labs really come into play.
It's hard.
I mean, am I tired? Because, or the other end of the spectrum, patients who become hyperthyroid or autoimmune overactivity. Why am I having trouble sleeping? Is it my hot flashes or is it overactive thyroid?
Exactly. And I was going to ask you about that because I will see that. I will see a suppressed TSH, yeah. And the women will complain of things like anxiety or heart palpitations or insomnia. Yeah. But interestingly, it doesn't seem like it has to be that low for them to have those effects.
Right.
I'm thinking maybe 0.9. I think it's low, but I guess
but not super low. Yeah. Exactly. Because I think that, you know, if we can catch the free levels, so sometimes it's the free levels or even reverse T3 could be playing a part there too. So, if you have, and especially if someone's not on thyroid hormone replacement, they're very sensitive to the low TSHs. They tend to feel more hyperthyroid easily.
So when they're not actually diagnosed with hyperthyroidism, like they don't meet all the criteria, what do they do when it's just mildly suppressed or running low?
Great question.
I feel like that one's harder.
That one's harder. I mean, and if they're not on thyroid hormone replacement and they feel hyperthyroid and we don't think it's menopause related or perimenopause, that's where checking thyroid antibodies are going to help out.
Okay.
Because that's where you can pick up. So in that case, not in addition to just thyroid antibodies for Hashimoto, I would check TSI, which is thyroid stimulated immunoglobulin, which is the antibody that goes along with overactivity thyroid.
Oh, okay. I haven't checked that one. So when it's high, do that. TSI. Okay. Check levels.
Or even check for that could be a transient inflammation in the thyroid or thyroiditis. So like an like SED rate is a great marker for thyroiditis.
Oh, okay. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about weight management. I know we were kind of talking about that initially. What are some of the other hormonal issues that women face during perimenopause and menopause that make it very difficult for us to lose weight?
Okay, that is a great question because weight is so complicated.
Yes.
Yes. So yes, thyroid hormone is the hormone that controls metabolism. And yes, we want it to be optimized. But sometimes we're going in on a weight loss journey, just optimizing the thyroid doesn't always get us where we need to be. It can be meal planning, exercising, getting your water in, trying to just do all the right things and nothing's happening. Especially in perimenopause and menopause, that tends to be insulin resistant. So basically insulin's a storage hormone and a growth hormone. So when we take in a meal, insulin goes up, insulin's released from the pancreas, goes up, takes that glucose in and stores it in our fat cells for use for later. So more insulin goes up, the more we're storing away. The more we're storing away, the more insulin resistance develops. So it's really in that midsection that's the most concerning for cardiometabolic health. And I always stress to my patients, don't focus on the weight, focus on your overall health. So and I think as women, it's easy to get fixated on numbers. I think we've kind of all been there, and you want to work on health and your midsection. That's where the risk is. So, and that's insulin resistance. So if we really focus on the insulin resistance, getting past that insulin resistance barrier, then, you know, the thyroid hormone's rolling, your hormone replacement's rolling, your meal planning's rolling, your exercise is kicking in, you start seeing results. But it tends to be that insulin resistance that's kind of holding us back.
And we talked a little bit about it before we got on. And let's just talk a little bit about, we check insulin levels, and you were telling me fasting insulin doesn't always give the full picture. Just to talk about that a little bit, because I think that's really frustrating. You hear a lot about checking the fasting insulin, but then not everybody has a high fasting insulin, but they still have the midsection weight gain that we can't lose. It's very frustrating. What are the next steps? What's going on?
Yeah, so it still is probably insulin resistant. So you can have a normal blood sugar. You can have a normal fasting insulin. But what happens with insulin resistance, it's not always just the fasting insulin that can be high. It's the postprandial or post-meal insulin levels that are going high. So when you're taking in a meal, your insulin levels are going through the roof, store. And guess what? You're building more insulin resistance. And unfortunately, what happens is when insulin resistance goes up too, it feeds back to our brain and makes us more. So it's a defective survival mechanism at the very least. So that's where really tackling the insulin resistance and doing therapies that kind of go in that direction are the way to go. And I see a lot of results. So
what are the strategies? What is most effective for insulin resistance in perimenopause and menopause or whenever, but that just tends to be what our issue is. So what are the best strategies for insulin resistance?
So best strategies, you know, always it's going to be meal planning. So you got to be eat mindfully, meal plan, low carbohydrates. You want to make sure you have adequate fat and protein. That's where sitting down with a nutritionist who focuses on women in this age is a good thing. You want to keep stress to a manageable. I know we all have stress, but when stress is high, insulin resistance is high. It's a fact. And sleep has to be a priority because when we're not sleeping, that also messes up, makes us tired, makes our stress high, and that increases insulin resistance. Moving, I hate to say exercise. I like to exercise, but a lot of my patients don't like the word exercise, so we just say moving. that's important. There are therapies that help out, and I know we were talking about GLP-1s before we got on, and I prescribe a lot of GLP-1s. I started prescribing GLP-1s or glucagon-like peptide 1 agonists. I've been caring for diabetes patients for 15 years. So they came around more than 15 years ago. So I've been using them for that long. So I feel pretty comfortable in them. And what I've noticed, what we all noticed in kind of the endocrine field was people didn't eat as much when they're on GLP-1 agonists for type 2 diabetes. And that's what translated over to more recently the weight loss spectrum, because insulin resistance holds us back from losing weight. And GLP-1s, what GLP-1s do is they increase our insulin sensitivity. They do slow down some gastric motility, so that makes us fuller longer. And then the weight loss is kind of a side effect. So not to say that, you know, you have to be on something like that for forever. And I'm not saying it's the answer for everyone. And I'm not saying that there aren't people that aren't good candidates for it. But it does work for a lot of people. And even for a month or 2 months, it gets the ball rolling past that insulin resistance barrier so that you can see the benefits of everything that you're doing. Because I think that's the most frustrating thing is you're trying, but nothing's happening. Now, what's also interesting is there's natural ways that maybe boost our own GLP-1. So things like berberine help out. There's a cool new probiotic out there that has acromantia in it, and that tends to increase our natural GLP-1. But I think GLP-1 agonists are not going away anytime soon.
Right. And I think that they have been shown to decrease inflammation.
Yep.
There are some other benefits. Do you typically use, are these usually like weekly injections and mm-hmm. they start at a lower dose and then work up to a certain dose and then maybe maintain a certain dose for a few months or however long, or how long term can this be? What do you typically see? Obviously it's individual.
All individual. And it kind of depends upon the level of insulin resistance. And I should also add, these medicines don't work without you working on diet and exercise and all the lifestyle modification thing. But we usually start them at a low dose once a week. And then as long as we're seeing a result at that dose, you just stay at that dose. If we hit a plateau, then that's where you go up in dosing.
Can you combine those with other therapies like metformin? I mean, what are you still using metformin? Is that's been around for a long time. What do you still use that in combination?
Oh yeah, we use it. I don't use it for weight loss. It really doesn't work too much for weight loss. But for type 2 diabetes, we keep with that and then add on therapy to that.
Okay. And berberine you can use also with the GLP-1s, because I get a lot of questions on berberine. I think it's great. It's got really good studies. Just varying on how long you can use it, I think, depending, because it does have some gut impact. It's antimicrobial. So I guess mm-hmm. you want to stay on it forever. But no, thanks for sharing that about the GLP-1s. I think that, you know, you hear so many bad things about it, myself included, that you do feel almost judged if you use them or if you don't use them. It's a whole big thing. So I'm so glad you talked about it. Have you personally seen any of those big side effects that have been in the news, you know, any of the cancers or any of those major things that have occurred, you know, they've been accused of?
Yeah. So the debate on thyroid cancer is that's like an hour long conversation in of itself. So, yeah. Me personally, seeing GLP-1s causing thyroid cancer, no. And it's a specific type. It kind of dates back to the initial studies on GLP-1s where they, back in the days of Byetta. So Byetta was the first GLP-1 we had, and they studied rats, and they dosed these poor rats with really high doses of exenatide, which was Byetta, and they developed medullary thyroid cancer. So medullary thyroid cancer is a very rare type of cancer, and rats have very different thyroids than we do. So that's where kind of the screening or keeping it on the watch. What we're seeing now is we're screening more and we're picking up thyroid cancer more. So yeah, I can't say that it's related to GLP-1s. We do know that thyroid cancer is decreased when we have decreased inflammation. So if we're using a therapy that decreases inflammation, then I think it's beneficial. As far as major side effects that I've ever seen in the past, I mean, gastroparesis. I've never seen gastroparesis be so bad. You know, I've seen constipation happen with these medicines. And in that case, you either have to stay on top of the constipation or you just stop the medicine and it goes away. You don't want to use these medicines in patients with pancreatitis history. I have seen someone who said that they didn't have pancreatitis in the past, but developed pancreatitis, ended up in the hospital with pancreatitis. I mean, everything turned out all right, but you just got to be careful.
Yeah, pancreatitis, that's a bad one. We talked a little bit about Hashimoto's, it being the most common hypothyroid condition. Do you feel like the autoimmune increases because, like we talked about, due to the hormonal fluctuations of perimenopause and menopause, kind of like, I guess, the same thing as a stressful event, maybe that is why it's increasing as we age? You feel like that's really...
I think so. It's probably likely a combination of factors. And, you know, as we go through life, you know, we're exposed to things and that kind of lowers our threshold for managing immune imbalance.
So. What are some of the most common questions you get about Hashimoto's? I feel like there's misconceptions, different things to do, to not do, take this, don't take that. What are the most common things that you address when it comes to Hashimoto's?
Well, I really work on gut health and immune balance, because if you can stop the immune assault, kind of like I was mentioning earlier, you can prevent the progression. I was taught in the past, I mean, I was trained traditionally. Once a person has Hashimoto thyroiditis, there's no point in rechecking antibodies because they have it. So you just give them thyroid hormone replacement, call it a day. But you're not really, treating an autoimmune condition is not as easy as just handing someone a pill and just calling it a day. I mean, you really want to address the whole person.
Do you use T3 and T4 or do you?
Oh, yeah.
And do you feel like women in general get a better response adding some T3? I'm sure it's individual, obviously, but just all of the other issues that we're dealing with as we age, what is your experience with the combinations?
I use a lot of T3. I mean, again, it depends upon the patient. So about when we look at studies where we take out patients' thyroids and we look at, you know, what happens, about 20% of the 20% of those patients don't convert T4 to T3 over very well. And we do, there's studies ongoing and we know about deiodinases. So deiodinases are the enzymes that convert T4 to T3. There are genetic abnormalities in a large percentage of our population of people that don't convert over very well.
Wow.
So either adding T3 to a synthetic T4 or natural thyroid thing, not like desiccated thyroid hormone, like NP thyroid, is an option in those persons.
Real quick, how can women better advocate for themselves during this time? What, a lot of times, I'm sure you've heard this, that they still don't feel well and they're told everything is normal. So how can we better advocate for ourselves to get the proper therapy so that we do feel better?
Right. And that's a challenge. And that's what we're working. I do train fellow physicians in this area, and we're working on building more awareness of the patient's perspective on thyroid, being more aware of addressing patients' concerns rather than just looking at labs. And that's the whole reason that we do the podcast. I wrote the book, and then there's a masterclass.
Let's just finish up with some recommendations that come from your book, some key takeaways that maybe some actionable steps that women can take to optimize their thyroid health.
Sure. All right. So kind of a list of my go-tos for thyroid health, yes, if you will. So first off, listen to your body, listen how you're feeling. If you don't feel like something is right, you know, pursue it. Don't ignore it. Number two is try and eat optimally too. I mean, even though thyroid levels, we want them to be optimal, what you put in your body is important too. So we want to make sure our body has what it needs as far as micronutrients and has what it doesn't want, like processed foods and inflammatory foods. I always stress the importance of stress management, because stress is tough. Our thyroids do not like stress. It is not good for our thyroids. Neither is it good for a lot of the other parts of our body. I stress, I always want people to think about their gut because the gut is so important. Because if your gut's not healthy, that speaks volumes for the rest of you. And that means it can lead to thyroid issues. And then I always talk about daily detox because our thyroid, again, is so sensitive to things. And there's so many disruptors out there that can mess up thyroid function. We're exposed to 85,000 different chemicals on a regular basis, and we don't even know what 10% of them are. So, and a lot of them can disrupt our thyroid. So helping our body, we can't get away from them, but helping our body better manage them by kind of even just sweating on a daily basis helps our body detox. So those would be my go-tos.
Are you a fan of ashwagandha?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I think there was some controversy on that and Hashimoto's. So
yeah, no, it's completely safe in Hashimoto. There was like some isolated reports of ashwagandha issues and hyperthyroidism. So I don't even see how that's an issue.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being here and a great conversation. Where can everybody locate you and follow you?
Sure, sure. Well, our website is metabolic centerforwellness.com. The book is Thyroid Talk, An Integrative Guide to Optimal Thyroid Health. The podcast is Thyroid Talk with Dr. Angela Mazza, available on most streaming channels and YouTube. We have a YouTube channel, Dr. Angela Mazza, and we have the online masterclass. And you can check out thrivethyroid.com and you can sign up for a free webinar to learn more.
Awesome. All right. Well, great. Thanks for being here. And I've really had a great time. We've learned a lot, and maybe we'll do it again sometime.
Sounds good. Thanks so much for having me, Kim. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a good conversation. Have a great rest of your day.
You too.